All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 628 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. This is going to be series 131. All right. So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, is a 32-year-old male, and you're told that he has a history of Hashimoto's thyroiditis and he's currently on levothyroxine therapy. And then you're told that, you know, for the last 6 months, he has been having a lot of vomiting after meals, right? So a lot of postprandial vomiting, and that he feels full very, very early. And then, you know, you're told that he has a lot of abdominal pain, and that when he is, you know, that he has been having like some minor weight loss over the last 2-3 months. And then they ask you which of the following represents the most appropriate next best step in management. I would really hope you're picking the answer that says to check this person's A1C. You're like, what? Divine. Okay, this is 2026, buddy. Like, what are you doing here? Okay, so let's kind of talk through this, right? This stuff is actually pretty high yield to know for your exams, right? So the first thing I think we're going to start off with is that it's important to know this principle with the USMLE exams. Whenever they're testing an autoimmune disease, they will almost always give you a past medical history of another autoimmune disease. I'm going to say that again. When the USMLEs are testing an autoimmune disease, I can almost guarantee they'll give you, not always, but a lot of the time, they'll give you a past medical history of another autoimmune disease. So what other autoimmune disease does this person have? This person potentially has type 1 diabetes, right? Because we see this person has a history of Hashimoto's, which is an autoimmune disease where you damage the thyroid glands, right? Antithyroperoxidase or antithyroglobulin antibodies, right? So it behooves us that this person may actually have another autoimmune disease like type 1 diabetes, right? Remember, in type 1 diabetes, you can have anti-insulin antibodies, you can have anti-islet polypeptide antibodies, you can have anti-glutamate decarboxylase antibodies, right? So what is going on with this person's diabetes that is causing them to vomit after they eat, not want to eat, losing minor amounts of weight, feeling full early, right? If you see something like this, you want to think about gastroparesis, right? You want to think about what? Diabetic gastroparesis. Whenever you see a person that's a diabetic and they have a lot of GI problems, think of diabetic gastroparesis. Think of diabetic gastroparesis, right? So again, they feel full early, they have aversion to food, they have abdominal pain, right? They eat and boom, very, very quickly, they feel very, very full. Really, really fast. Whenever you see something like this, I absolutely positively want you to think about diabetic gastroparesis. So now the big question is, how are we going to diagnose this? Well, you can do a gastric emptying study, right? Remember, diabetes can cause neuropathy, right? So these people essentially have like a neuropathy of the stomach. And when you have that neuropathy, right? When you have that neuropathy, you're going to have issues with peristalsis in your GI tract, right? So in fact, sometimes on the exams, I think I was kind of telling people this recently at one of my classes, that the USMLEs these days, they don't give straight answers, right? They're going to give you derivative answers, right? So why put gastroparesis as an answer to a gastroparesis question where they can just put reduced GI tract peristalsis or something like that, right? Many times these days on the USMLE exams, most of the answers that they throw out there are answers that are pathophysiological answers. They relate in some way, shape, or form, pathophysiology-wise, to the pathology that they are referring to in the question stem, right? So this person has gastroparesis, and you're going to do a gastric emptying study. Again, it's like a paralysis, like neuropathy of the person's GI tract. So how are we going to manage this person's neuropathy? Well, typically, to diagnose it first, you're going to do a gastric emptying study, right? Because things are going to take longer to empty through the GI tract, right? So the gastric emptying study is going to be abnormal. They're going to have a longer latency of gastric emptying. It's going to take a much longer time for the stomach to empty. But it is also high yield to know that, hey, how are we going to manage this? Well, the first line treatment is going to be a prokinetic agent like metoclopramide. You're going to use what? Metoclopramide. Remember, how does metoclopramide work? Metoclopramide is a D2 receptor blocker. It's a dopamine receptor antagonist. It pretty much works like an antipsychotic, right? But by doing that, it's actually going to promote GI motility, right? But there are some offshoot points that our friends at the MBMEs love to integrate, right? They love to integrate into this thing, right? And one of the offshoot things they love to integrate into this is a person that is being treated for gastroparesis. And then you notice that, this person is now having these abnormal tongue movements. Well, obviously, you want to think about tardive dyskinesia. It's going to be a person that has taken the metoclopramide for a long period of time, right? They have tardive dyskinesia. Because again, remember, metoclopramide effectively works. In fact, it's not effectively. It is essentially an antipsychotic. It just happens to be repurposed for the management of diabetic gastroparesis, right? So they can have like tardive dyskinesia. They can even give you a neuroleptic malignant syndrome question in a person that has diabetic gastroparesis, right? So they give you, again, a person that has managed diabetic gastroparesis, and the person has very high body temperatures, very high fevers, right? The person has like severe muscle pain, and you're told that the person's urine is red. When you see something like that, think of neuroleptic malignant syndrome. So you may be wondering, Divine, why would this person have red urine? Again, the person has red urine because they've started having rhabdomyolysis, right? Neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Remember, they're going to have high fevers. They're going to have muscle rigidity. Their muscles can start breaking down, right? And as your muscles break down, you begin to have rhabdomyolysis, right? And that can cause your creatinine to rise. So they can ask you a question about, hey, this person's creatinine is like 2.something. What's the mechanism behind this person's whatever, right? You want to pick the rhabdomyolysis answer or the acute kidney injury answer or the acute tubular necrosis answer, right? And again, the urine is red because you're seeing myoglobin, not hemoglobin, right? You're seeing what? You're seeing myoglobin, not hemoglobin, right? They can even ask you, they can even give you a question about a person that has NMS, and then they show you an EKG, and then you see tall peak T waves, or you notice that the person's QRS is really wide. And then they ask you, oh, which of the following is the most likely mechanism behind the observed EKG findings? Well, I would really hope you're picking the answer that says electrolyte abnormality, right? Well, what's the electrolyte abnormality in this case? It's going to be hyperkalemia. Because again, remember, potassium is primarily an intracellular ion, right? So as a lot of cells explode, you're going to release a lot of potassium into the bloodstream. And that potassium that is released into the bloodstream can cause hyperkalemia, right? So that person, believe it or not, you may get a question on a person that has neuroleptic malignant syndrome, and they give you EKG findings. And then your next step on your exams is actually to give them IV calcium gluconate to stabilize that myocardium, Again, I know some people may be uncomfortable with this method of review where it's like I'm cutting across concept to concept, concept to concept, concept to concept. But if I'm being completely honest with you, this is how the USMLEs layer their questions these days, right? So the thing is, you want to go through this mental discomfort in your learning so that when you see those kinds of things on your exams, you're more apt to pick up on those things, right? So just keep this at the back of your mind, right? So again, we started this whole journey, right? Let's backtrack our story with diabetic gastroparesis, with the first line treatment being metoclopramide, and then saying that metoclopramide is a D2 antagonist, right? So because it's a D2 blocker, it pretty much gives you everything that you can get from an antipsychotic, right? You can get tardive dyskinesia, you can get neuroleptic malignant syndrome, you can get Parkinsonism, you can get many of these things, right? And remember, if a person is on metoclopramide and they develop like a small bowel obstruction, it's not a very good idea to keep them on that metoclopramide. You should probably go ahead and discontinue that metoclopramide. Why? Because it's a prokinetic agent. You really should not be taking a prokinetic agent when you have a small bowel obstruction, because that can increase your risk of bowel rupture, and that can be very bad for the patient, right? In fact, they can give you a question about a person that, you know, is on metoclopramide, and the person has been on, is a person is on metoclopramide, and then for the last 2 days, the person has been vomiting, blah, 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 right? And they'll tell you that their symptoms were previously well controlled. And then now they seem to have all this vomiting, you know, they have like this abdominal bloating and all these things. And then they give you a chest radiograph and you notice free air under the diaphragm. They can ask, oh, which of the following represents the most appropriate next best step in management? You want to go ahead and do exploratory laparotomy, okay? You want to go ahead and do what? Exploratory laparotomy, because the person has developed bowel rupture. They've ruptured a viscus. So that person is going to need XLAP. Okay. So going back to gastroparesis, what did we say was first line treatment? We said it was going to be metoclopramide. Well, what's going to be the second line treatment for diabetic gastroparesis? The second line treatment is erythromycin, right? Erythromycin. So why would you use erythromycin? Well, the thing is, erythromycin is a motilin receptor agonist. It's a motilin receptor agonist. It literally stimulates the motilin receptor. Whenever you stimulate the motilin receptor, whenever you stimulate the motilin receptor, that's going to encourage GI tract motility. And as you have that GI tract motility, that's going to be helpful. So you may wonder, like, Divine, I mean, like, you've just told me a lot of bad things about metoclopramide. Like, you've told me about how it causes NMS, causes tardive dyskinesia and all these things. Why would we pick that over a benign macrolide like erythromycin? Well, let me explain something. Well, the thing is, there's this phenomenon, unfortunately, known as tachyphylaxis that operates with erythromycin, right? So it's going to help your symptoms of diabetic gastroparesis really fast. But after a while, you lose the effect of it. So you almost need like some kind of drug-free holiday. Well, those drug-free holiday issues do not apply with metoclopramide. So that's why metoclopramide is preferred, right? Is preferred over erythromycin, right? But erythromycin works really well, right? And hopefully this thing that I've told you that, oh, erythromycin is a motilin receptor agonist, this helps you understand why macrolides can cause diarrhea as a side effect. It's actually a very common side effect of macrolides, right? Because they stimulate motilin receptors, they increase GI tract motility, and that can certainly increase your risk of having diarrhea, okay? Increase your risk of having diarrhea. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and you're told that this patient has had gastric bypass, you know, like 2 years ago, and that this patient was lost to follow up. This person has not followed up with her physician for the last, 6 months or whatever, right? And you're told in the history that this person has been having very heavy periods. And then you're told that this person has been having a lot of sleep problems, that in fact, she has been caught sleeping on the job multiple times. She's been having a lot of sleep problems, right? And you're told that, she notices that when she goes to bed, she has this uncomfortable urge, right? To move her legs, right? When she goes to bed. And then they ask you, which of the following is the most appropriate next best step in management? Well, I would really hope you're picking the answer that says to check serum ferritin. So again, I know some of you are like, Divine, come on, check serum ferritin. What in the world are you thinking here? Okay, so let's put it all together. Let's make integrations, because that's supposed to be your job on the exams. Your job on the exams is to make integrations, right? So what does this patient have? This patient has restless legs syndrome, right? So let's discuss this case, right? This person has restless legs syndrome, but how did she get there from gastric bypass? Okay, let's layer the story. So number one, she had gastric bypass. Remember, when people have gastric bypass, they literally bypass big portions of the stomach. You pretty much connect the stomach, like early stomach to distal small intestine. That's the connection you make. There's all these other permutations, but that's the basic idea, the basic gist you want to know for your exams, right? You connect the proximal stomach to the distal small intestine. So think about it. You're pretty much bypassing pretty huge sections of the small intestine, right? Pretty huge sections of the small intestine, like the duodenum and like the jejunum. And if you think about it, where do we reabsorb iron in the GI tract? We reabsorb it in the duodenum, right? So it behooves us that a person that has had gastric bypass, because they have literally bypassed sections of the small intestine that help with iron reabsorption, like the duodenum, those people can develop iron deficiency anemia, right? This is why close follow-up is extremely important in a person that has gotten gastric bypass, right? In fact, sometimes they can make USMLE questions where they ask, which of the following is one of the key determinants of the patient, risk of developing complications from this procedure, aka a gastric bypass? It's actually close follow-up with the physician. That's actually a prognosis question, believe it or not, that they can repurpose and throw on your exams, right? So these people need to, number one, follow up with their physicians, and number two, they need to take a ton of supplements. They need to take a lot of multivitamins, because again, because of the way their GI tract, especially for the early parts, you know, first few months, first few years after they get that bypass, right? Because over time, the GI tract learns to adapt in some way, shape, or form. But early, it's not, right? So they're not reabsorbing iron. So they can absolutely positively develop iron deficiency anemia, right? And that iron deficiency anemia has led to this person's restless legs syndrome, right? Has led to this person's restless legs syndrome. Remember, restless legs syndrome has a very, very strong association with iron deficiency, especially given the other risk that I gave in this question of, oh, the person has been having very heavy menses. Well, that's a very nice rapid way to develop iron deficiency anemia, right? That's a very, very nice rapid way to develop iron deficiency anemia. Very, very nice rapid way to develop iron deficiency anemia, right? So the person, number one, is like they have a double whammy. Number one, they're not reabsorbing iron in the lumen of the GI tract because, again, the duodenum has been bypassed because they got gastric bypass. But number two, they're losing a lot of blood, right? Because they are menstruating, right? So that's potentiating the iron deficiency, right? So that iron deficiency has led to this person's restless legs syndrome. So how are we going to treat this? Or why are we checking the ferritin? Well, remember, ferritin is a measure of your iron stores, right? Ferritin is a measure of your iron stores. It's a measure of what? Of your iron stores. So whenever your iron is low, whenever you have iron deficiency anemia, your ferritin is going to be low. Right? Your ferritin is going to be low. So this person is not going to get the classic restless leg syndrome therapy that we're used to giving people, right? This person should probably go ahead and get supplemental iron, okay? The person should get supplemental iron. The person should get supplemental iron. And that's going to be more than enough to take care of her restless leg syndrome symptoms, okay? So keep this at the back of your mind for your exams. Now, there's this thing I just want to say. It's just one of these constructs that our friends at the MBMEs love to introduce on exams to see if you can make certain integrations with iron, right? So the thing is, there are certain conditions that seem to improve when you've lost blood. There are certain conditions that seem to improve when you've lost blood on the USMLE exams, right? So let's kind of collate them together and run through them, right? So number one, for example, will be a person that has porphyria cutanea tarda, right? Whenever you see a person that, you know, they seem to have like this chronic skin rash, this chronic skin bruising, right? This, you know, strange color of their urine, discoloration of their urine. And they tell you that their symptoms have improved, you know, improved temporarily after they lost a lot of blood. You want to think about porphyria cutanea tarda. Well, how does that work exactly? Well, if you think about it, porphyria cutanea tarda is a disease. It's a defect in the enzyme UROD, uroporphyrinogen decarboxylase. Uroporphyrinogen decarboxylase is an enzyme that you can be deficient in, and then that can cause you to have PCT, right? Porphyria cutanea tarda. It's one of those porphyrias, right? It's one of those porphyrias, right? They're gonna have skin issues, right? That's why it's called porphyria cutanea. Excuse me, right? So porphyria cutaneous, right? It affects the skin, porphyria cutanea tarda, right? So they have a lot of cutaneous manifestations and they may have discolored urine, right? So why is it that bleeding may help these people's symptoms get better? Well, bleeding helps these people's symptoms get better if you think about the treatment of PCT. If you think about the treatment of porphyria cutanea tarda, one of the primary treatments is to do phlebotomy. When you do phlebotomy, right? When you do phlebotomy, you're going to create an iron deficiency. Whenever you have a mild iron deficiency, it's actually going to increase the activity of UROD. So whatever uroporphyrinogen decarboxylase you have hanging around works better when you have an iron deficiency, okay? When you have an iron deficiency. So if this person is bleeding or this person is having, you know, pretty heavy menses, it makes sense that their symptoms will improve. And remember, whenever a person has porphyria cutanea tarda, those people have to be screened for hepatitis C, right? There's a very strong association between hep C and having porphyria cutanea tarda. All right, now, what's another disorder that improves with bleeding and stuff? Well, I want you to think, hopefully, of polycythemia vera, right? In fact, this is why women tend to present with symptoms of polycythemia vera later in life versus men that tend to present with symptoms of polycythemia vera earlier in life. In fact, let me tell you something amazing here. Our friends at the MBMEs, they can literally make a biostatistics question of this. You notice that, wow, they give you like some cross-sectional study or whatever, or some kind of research study that talks about the thing that they're studying is the incidence or the prevalence of polycythemia vera. And you notice that for the men, they seem to have it like starting in their 40s, you know, you see like this, they'll give you like some graph and you see the incidence kind of increasing starting in the 40s. But then you see for women, you see the incidence kind of starting in the 50s. And then they'll say which of the following biological mechanisms, right? Or which of the following pathophysiological mechanisms underlies the observed graph findings. Well, I would really, really hope you're picking the answer that talks about, right, like a woman's menstrual cycle or whatever, right? Because if you're a woman and you have menses, you're pretty much getting an autophlebotomy every single month when you have your periods, right? You're losing some blood, that is reducing some iron. That's going to help your symptoms of polycythemia vera, right? Because remember, in polycythemia vera, you have a JAK2 mutation and then you have excess hematocrit, right? So you can have all these issues, right? You can have all these problems with headaches, blurry vision, blah, 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 right? But women don't have this, at least until they hit menopause, and then that hack that they have of autophlebotomy every month with losing blood, you know, through their menses. They don't have that anymore, right? And then they start having symptoms. So keep that at the back of your mind for your exams. In fact, the USMLEs, one of their, fun fact about the USMLEs these days, one of their favorite kinds of questions is to integrate biostatistics with like another subject, right? I like to call them sometimes like internal medicine biostatistics questions, IM bio questions, right? It's an IM question, but it's fused with biostatistics, right? So they're trying to see if you can simultaneously apply pathophysiological knowledge from like internal medicine or peds or whatever, and then they bring in biostats with it, right? So it's just something I want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, okay? So again, I think we're kind of coming up on the 20-minute mark, so I think this is probably a good place to stop. Again, study this material, right? Again, the USMLEs, they love to test these things. And if you love the way I teach, you love the way I make integrations, you're going to absolutely love my classes. In the month of February, I have a 25-hour step one class. Good for people taking step one or people taking step two, step three with bad basic science foundations, right? And then I have a 20-hour step two class that's for step two and step three. And then I have a last-minute review that is also for step two and step three. And then for step one to step three, you know, besides the 25-hour step one class, I have a test-taking strategies class that's 2.5 hours long. I have a biostatistics class that's 4 hours long. And I have a social sciences quality improvement hospital medicine review, ethics review that is 5 hours long. Again, many people have taken these classes and found them to be extremely helpful. So if you're interested, they're all held over Zoom. They're live classes. Shoot me an email and I'll give you some more information. And then I also offer one-on-one tutoring, and I also help with ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements, recommendation letters, and things of that nature. So thank you for listening to me today. You can check out this podcast on divineinterventionpodcast.com. There's also this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. And then I also have a YouTube channel where I post the videos that I make. And then I have another website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com, divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Many of you know I'm a Christ follower, I'm a Christian. So every week I make like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. There's actually an Apple podcast there called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, in episode 629. Have a wonderful day. God bless you, and bye for now. Thank you.